Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and our next guests are co-authors of a new book that explains how to find edible mushrooms and how to prepare them. It's a beautiful book with some wonderful photography and some great sounding recipes and a lot of good information about the mushrooms we're going to be talking about today. Things like hedgehogs and puffballs and lion's mane and oysters and chicken of the woods or hen of the woods, that's they're sometimes called, morels, pheasant backs. All of those mushrooms are featured, and many more are featured in the book. And the authors, one of them, Michael Carnes, certified mycological identification expert. He's a photographer, design professional. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Also with us from Minnesota Public Radio Studios, Lisa Golden Schroeder, food journalist, food stylist, cookbook writer, and editor. Lisa, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Together with photographer Dennis Becker, they have published a beautiful new book. It's called Untamed Mushrooms from Field to Table. So, what are your favorite wild mushrooms? What's your favorite way to eat them? I hope you'll join in the conversation. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Lisa, maybe you can start. How did this book come about?
Well, Dennis Becker and I have a blog called Two Fish, One Dish that we started about 5 years ago, and we write about all kinds of regional food and agricultural topics and try to tell just really interesting kind of behind-the-scenes stories of people who are doing interesting things related to food, cooking, you know, the production of specialty food products. And we like to write about subjects that we don't know anything about because we like to learn something, too. And for a long time, we'd really wanted to learn about going out to forage for wild mushrooms. And we, you know, tossed around for a while trying to find the right person to talk to. And finally, some friends recommended Michael to us. And it turns out that we actually knew of Michael through other work channels. And he was kind enough to talk to us and was willing to take us out with a couple of his foraging friends. And we wrote a long story about him, and it was super fun. We had just a blast. Of course, he had gone out and scouted some fabulous things for us to see, which is very different from how the average person will probably experience foraging for the first time, where you could tramp around for a day and never find anything. And somebody sent the story on to the Minnesota Historical Society Press, and they asked us to do a longer story about the whole subject.
Oh, and that turned into this book.
Yes.
Michael, why did you decide to work on this book?
Because I'm mad about mushrooms. I'm going to get on board with anything that has to do with them.
Talk about how the book's arranged, just to give people an idea here. It's an absolutely beautiful book with some great stories and wonderful photography.
Well, we decided that it was really important to start with the information about identifying the different mushrooms, because, you know, a lot of people know morel mushrooms or maybe a handful of other wild varieties or species, but we really wanted to focus on a set number that are pretty easy to identify, so that, you know, people can get a little bit of confidence when they go out in the woods. So Michael really started off the book with 13 chapters. We chose 13 species, a baker's dozen of mushrooms, and he writes about each of those species. And then the second half of the book is recipes, and it's pretty much a full-size cookbook with over 100 recipes. So you can kind of work your way from the very start, you know, how to get started, and go all the way to the point of actually making a mushroom dinner for your friends and family.
Yeah, and those dinners look absolutely wonderful. And you've given us a couple that we can post up on our page too. One was grilled lake trout with a mess of morels, and another morel one, a tangle of spring greens with warm morels and lentils. Both sound really good to me.
Great.
Well, let's and Michael, you've been hunting mushrooms for a long, long time, haven't you?
Yeah, since I was a young kid.
Yeah. And how did you, are you completely self-trained, or how'd you learn?
I have been up until about the last year, where I've now been working in conjunction with Anna Garanday from the Minnesota Mycological Society. She is running the Minnesota Mycoflora Project, which is a project where we are seeking to create a compendium of all of the macrofungi in Minnesota. So we have kind of a catalog of what we have, what occurs here in Minnesota.
And mushrooms and mushroom hunting have become so popular.
It has.
Yeah. Is it just, why do you think now?
Well, I think that it's relative to, you know, when I was a kid, my parents did this back to the land thing where they kind of upped stakes and ran off to the woods and built a house. And it was kind of the fringe of that hippie movement. And I feel like that is now turned into go out in the woods, forage, join a CSA, all of these different little avenues. You know, go to the farmer's market. People want to be closer and more engaged to where their food is coming from.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. Give our listeners a chance to join in. Questions, give a call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Is that hunting mushrooms a tradition in your family? Do you have a mushroom hunting experience you want to share? Why do you like foraging for mushrooms? Give a call and let us know. So I mentioned several of the varieties, but and locating them, I was going to ask you about basic tips for locating mushrooms, and you do have some in your book. And it varies a little bit, I guess, depending on the type of mushroom.
Yeah, 100%. So there's basically two types of mushrooms. There are mushrooms that have a symbiotic relationship with another organism, a plant or a tree, and then there are saprobic mushrooms, which are actually eating some organic material, whether it's leaves or the wood, the cellulose and lignin that occurs or exists in dead and decaying trees. So for those mushrooms that would have that symbiotic relationship, or what's called a mycorrhizal relationship, you would be looking for the tree. So in the case of like morels have a relationship with elm or ash trees, and they fruit when the elm tree becomes distressed or dies and begins to die. So when you're looking in the woods for morels, you're really looking for elm trees. So if you go from elm tree to elm tree to elm tree, you're far more likely to be successful when looking for morels. If you're looking for chanterelles, you would be looking for oak trees in our region.
Yeah. Anne in Green Bay has a good question for you, I think. Anne, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Actually, I actually have two questions. My first question is, are we taking a food source from a wildlife that needs it? And second of all, if we keep taking all these mushrooms, how do they regenerate?
And you kind of addressed that in the book.
Yeah, a little bit. So, no, you're not really taking mushrooms from other animals or resource. You're not taking a resource from anything. It's a fruit just like a fruit, an apple on a tree is a fruit. So you're not harming the organism. There's lots of mushrooms that no human is ever going to see. I mean, I hear people talk all, in fact, this weekend I had somebody ask me about collecting oyster mushrooms from a popple tree where they were 40 feet off the ground. And clearly that tree is dead or it wouldn't have oyster mushrooms growing on it. So I just said, those are the ones you leave alone because you go climbing a dead popple tree 40 feet in the air and you're going to end up dead like the tree.
Well, it's good to know that we're not stealing. And you do talk about actually harvesting, though, as to kind of maintain the resource.
Well, yeah, there have been a lot of studies done on harvesting mushrooms. There was one large study that was done on chanterelle mushrooms in the Pacific Northwest, and they had control plots and collection plots, and the greatest impact they found on the decrease in the mushroom numbers was actually from walking on the ground. It's actually your footsteps compacting the soil. It wasn't harvesting the fruit of that mycelium. So you're not, from harvesting, you're not really affecting, and you're certainly not harming the organism. The organism lives under the ground. You know, you never see it, really. So in collecting those mushrooms, we have no studies to show that harvesting has any effect whatsoever on production.
No. Peter in New Holstein, on to you. Hi, Peter.
Hi, I had a question about chanterelles. I've found quite a few the last couple of years, and when I'm harvesting them, I don't know at what point, what do I look for to see when they've gone past their prime?
What do you look for to judge the quality of a wild chanterelle?
Well, typically, if you cut it from the ground or pull it and then cut the base, you'll be able to see if there are bug holes in it, and there would be little worm holes in the base of the mushroom, and you can feel them. Typically, they should have a nice firm texture to them and not kind of be, as the name denotes, mushy.
That's the scientific way to put it.
Yeah, exactly.
Our guests today, Michael Carnes and Lisa Golden-Schroeder. Lisa is a food journalist, food stylist, cookbook writer, and editor. She blogs on fooddesigns.com. Michael Carnes, certified mycological identification expert, a photographer, and design professional. And their book, Untamed Mushrooms. They'll be with us till 12:30, so you stay with us. Talking about finding and preparing wild mushrooms today. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Our guests are Michael Carnes, a certified mycological identification expert, photographer, design professional, and Lisa Golden-Schroeder, who is a food journalist, food stylist, cookbook writer, and editor. And together with photographer Dennis Becker, they have published a beautiful new book. It's gorgeous. It's called Untamed Mushrooms from Field to Table. So, questions from you about mushrooms. Do you have a favorite way to eat them? Why do you like looking for them if you do? Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. And we do have those two morel recipes up on our Facebook page right now. And Michael and Lisa, we have Jeff in Oregon who has a question for you. So let's just go right there. Jeff, thank you for calling.
My pleasure. My question is, what is the mushroom that I find on box elder trees, usually where there's a wound, a broken branch, or a break in the bark, and I eat them, and they're really good. What are they?
What do they look like?
They're round, white, and then they've got a nice, relatively thick stalk on it.
Well, Michael, what do you think?
Well, I'd be hesitant to eat something that I don't know what it is my first thought. Well, it, most likely it's oyster, but I can't make that claim absolute without having seen it.
Yeah, it's probably that was the first thing that popped into my head too. And Jeff, there's some nice photos of oyster mushrooms in this book, Untamed Mushrooms from Field to Table. You might want to take a look at them just to see, but that's probably what you've got there. Let's go to Arlene in Madison. Arlene, hi.
Good morning. Maybe it's good afternoon already. Yes. Anyway, I wanted to comment on, well, I've traveled all over the world, but one of the most fascinating and delicious meals that I've ever had is out in the middle of the boonies somewhere in Turkey, and it was a restaurant that served nothing but mushrooms. everything on the menu, from salad through entrees through desserts, were made with mushrooms.
That's really fascinating.
That sounds fantastic.
Yeah, Lisa, I bet, yeah. Have you come across another place like that, Lisa?
You know, not brick-and-mortar restaurants, but certainly pop-up dinners. There are actually local chefs here in the Twin Cities that do just mushroom dinners, you know, exactly the same way from appetizer to dessert. And, you know, in season, so often you'll see morel dinners, but you can see, you know, dinners that run all the way into the fall when king boletes are prime or hen of the woods. And, Michael, you know a number of chefs who do specialized dinners.
Yeah. Alan Burgo from the Forager Chef is one who does that pretty typically every year.
It sounds like a great meal, Arlene.
Wonderful.
Thank you. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, let's go to Mark in Altoona. Hi, Mark.
Hello. I have had mixed results, like taking mushrooms sometimes that I pick from my yard and sometimes that I get from the store, and then drying those and crumbling them and trying to use them to season along. And I'm wondering if there's a timing on that as far as the time of the year or, you know, is there any special timing that goes with trying to seed your lawn with mushrooms?
Hmm.
And on top of that, my lawn has these big pine trees.
Okay. All right. Thanks for calling, Mark. Michael, what do you think?
Well, cultivating mushrooms is a whole other realm, but there are very specific requirements for each of those species out there for them to actually be successful. I mean, if every spore from a mushroom grew to fruition and became a mycelial organism that was successful, we'd be up to our necks in mycelium the entire globe over. So I would say that, you know, if you're looking for a specific mushroom to be successful in cultivating it, you need to study that specific one. I mean, it's like oyster mushrooms are a common mushroom that people are now trying to, you know, have a little backyard garden addition to inoculate some logs, or shiitake mushrooms are very common for doing that. So either of those species, they have very specific requirements in order to successfully propagate. But just taking mushrooms and putting them in your yard is not likely to produce much of anything.
Yeah. I remember a long time back getting a log and trying shiitake mushrooms. I had, and I thought I followed the directions exactly, but I must say I had limited success even when I had a whole setup.
Sure.
It didn't work as well as I'd hoped it would. Yeah, for sure. Well, Suzanne in Madison, your turn. Hi, Suzanne.
Hello. I've been looking for morels for 30 years, majorly addicted to doing that. And my spouse calls me the truffle pig of morel hunting because I always find them and give them away and, you know, have the fun of that and eat a few. But this year, what I want to know about is this year of the 30 years I've been looking, on many, many dead elms, broken elms, elms lying on their side, there's been a huge proliferation of golden oyster mushrooms. I mean, just as though the entire trunk of the tree is covered in, like, clumps and clumps and clumps of gold or golden oyster mushrooms. I've been picking them and processing them at home and eating them, making tremendous mushroom lasagna. But I can't figure out why would that happen. I've never seen them in 30 years, never.
Oh. What do you think, Michael?
Well, I can tell you exactly what it is. So there was that is an escaped cultivar. That is not a native mushroom to the United States. It's a mushroom that was being produced in mushroom farms, and there was, I believe, in Iowa, a huge fire at a mushroom farm, and all those spores got carried on the wind in the smoke, and that mushroom has now just exploded over the Midwest. And I'm not sure what to think about that. As an invasive species, it worries me considerably that it's going to be pushing out other native species. The mycelium, you know, there's an underground war that occurs, you know, two mycelium will not occur at the same place at the same time. I mean, there are some that interact with one another and they can live cohabitatively in an area as long as the resources are together. But I'm curious to see. There's actually a big study going on right now where they're trying to follow the progression of that mushroom and where it's being shown. So much like the Mycoflora Project that I'm a part of here in Minnesota, there's another project that's just specifically interested in where that mushroom is occurring throughout the Midwest because it is rapidly growing.
Oh. Suzanne, where are you finding it, in the Madison area, or?
Mostly I've looked this year in Dane County.
Yeah, so.
It's just everywhere.
Yeah. So there's some information for you, Michael. It's in Dane County for sure.
All right. Good to know.
Thanks, Suzanne, for calling. Darcy in East Troy, your turn.
Yes, good morning. I had a kit of oyster mushrooms I had in my home that was very successful, and I found spores covering everything in that area. And this last week I had transplanted another hibiscus plant I had growing near to where I had the oyster mushrooms. And I had a proliferation of something that came up in my hibiscus pot. Does not look like oyster mushrooms, but I'm wondering, is there another kind of oyster mushroom that this could be also?
It's not another oyster mushroom. It's probably just, as the oyster mushrooms are being successful, all of the environmental factors, the situation is just ripe for those mushrooms to sprout.
And you know, if you don't know what the mushroom is, you don't want to be eating it.
Oh, for certain.
Yeah, there are some mushrooms growing in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, well, they're probably everywhere, that if you ate them, you're not going to live. Pretty much, right?
Unfortunately, that is true. Fortunately, however, there are only really about a handful of mushrooms that are truly deadly poisonous. There are several others that will make you wish you were dead for a couple of days, but they're not likely to kill you.
Well, that's kind of what I like about your book here. You have zeroed in on 13 mushrooms that are fairly easy to identify. Are they not?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I can attest to the fact that I was, as I said earlier, I really had never hunted wild mushrooms before I met Michael, and I feel pretty confident now about going out into the woods as long as I'm looking for these 13 species.
Yeah, I think that's a major thing. And they're so beautiful. The photography in your book on the lion's mane is such a beautiful mushroom. It's just. Go ahead, Lise.
I was going to say there's such a diversity in how each of these varieties look, and I think that's what's so fascinating. And I believe that, you know, we're hoping that it's pretty eye opening for people who just want to learn a little bit more about wild mushrooms, whether they actually get out into the woods hunting or not. to, you know, just get a sense of what an amazing world the world of fungi is.
Oh, absolutely. And those pheasant backs, what an appropriate name for that mushroom.
No, it's true. The first time I saw the pheasant backs, Michael and Dennis had been out in the woods and, you know, had told me that they had gotten a nice harvest and were bringing some back to me for the kitchen. And I had no idea how large they can get. And so, you know, I think Dennis tried really hard for in some of the identification photos to try to show scale. But, you know, it's fairly obvious for, say, a hen of the woods or a chicken of the woods that grows along the base of or all the way up the side of an oak tree how large those mushrooms can be. But the pheasant backs can get to be the size of a very large dinner plate and even bigger. And it's pretty startling. When they arrived at my house with what they had collected, I couldn't believe my eyes. And I'd never seen them before, so... you know, those large ones really, really show the fact that that pattern on the caps looks very much like pheasant feathers. So they're quite astonishing.
They really are. Describe, if you can, the taste of that particular mushroom.
Well, you know, I think that the pheasant backs are, they're relatively mild. They're a little bit like, you know, other domesticated mushroom cultivars. The larger ones can be kind of woody in the center. So if you find some large ones, you really want to just kind of cut around the outside of the cap and chop them up and saute them in butter. That's always the number one best way to cook a mushroom. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people like to batter fry them and deep fry them. They can be used in any number of dishes that, you know, subbing them in for, you know, what you might otherwise normally just buy a grocery variety of mushroom. There's some people who pheasant backs aren't their favorite, and I think it's because pheasant backs appear in the spring in close tandem with morels, and people are so hot to find morels that, you know, they're more likely, if they're not looking in the right place, to find a pheasant back, and then they're, I think more than anything, they're just a little disappointed.
So. There you go. Well, speaking of morels, I think Dave and Baraboo has something relating to morels. Let's go there. Dave, hi. Thanks for waiting.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I had a couple, two questions, really. I've hunted morels quite a while, and it seems like the soil type makes a difference, and I wonder if that's true for other things. I've got a lot of dead elms, never find morels, but you know, you get down along the Wisconsin or down the Driftless area, and it seems to be the calcareous soils make the difference. The other comment, I'm wondering if anybody else has had this experience. I've eaten morels a long time, and roughly 10 years ago, I'd had to take antibiotics, oral antibiotics, for a tooth problem. And I ate morels with a friend, and I became violently ill. And this happened twice. Both ends came out over a period of hours, violent. Yeah.
Wow. Well, a couple of things there. Michael, you want to comment?
Sure. So morels are notorious for being interactive with other substances or compounds, and some people are just straight up allergic to morels. So alcohol is one thing. Eating morels in conjunction with alcohol can make you violently ill if you're one of those people that are sensitive in that way. And, you know, morels are, they're a mushroom that, well, and I say this with all wild mushrooms, especially because most people don't have a lot of interaction with them. Just try a little bit in the beginning. And clearly, you know, your caller had a lot of experience with morels, and this just was something that snuck up on him.
And in terms of the soil, he talked about the soil?
Yeah, morels are going to live in association with another plant, no matter what. They're always going to have an association with a tree, most likely. There are other trees besides elm that they associate with, and it will be interesting to see over the next few years with our area struggling with Dutch elm disease and emerald ash borer. We're losing two of the greatest associative trees for morels. They associate with cherry. They associate with cottonwood regularly. But with losing all of these elm and ash trees, it will be interesting to see if they develop a relationship with a different tree that historically they just haven't been as primed to do so.
Yeah. We have, before I go back to the phones for a second, these 13 that you have in your book, there aren't many lookalikes. There are some, I guess, but that would give you problems with the 13 you have in your book, Untamed Mushrooms.
Yeah, the 13 that are in the book, there's no deadly lookalike in there at all. And if, and really, chanterelles to jack-o'-lanterns are about the only one that I would attach as a lookalike. And jack-o'-lanterns grow on wood. Chanterelles grow on the ground. If you just take the descriptions and the definitions for how and what to look for that are in the book, you cannot make a mistake. Jack-o'-lanterns will sometimes grow on a root of a tree and appear to be coming out of the ground, but they grow in these massive clumps. Like they grow in a way that's called cespitose, which just means they all grow from a central origin. So you have this kind of crazy multi-legged stipe coming out of one center point that all the caps grow from. So it just grows in, like, almost like a broccoli from one stalk and then many, many florets. So in the case of jack-o'-lanterns, it's many caps from one stalk.
And Tom wondered, where do you typically find chanterelles and what time of the year, what to look for?
Chanterelles are coming up next. They'll be around the 1st of July is when I start seeing them in my area in the Twin Cities here. And from that point, they'll be available through the Midwest here through September. I still find them. And they associate with oak trees most commonly.
Most commonly around oak trees.
Yep.
Well, I looked through, I was looking through the book and my mouth was watering when I got Lisa, your recipes. And I'm going to try that grilled puffball bruschetta for sure. Puffballs are one that we can find here readily, and I always enjoy having them. And that recipe looks wonderful. And, well, they all looked... they all look great.
Look great.
Yeah, and you tried every one of them, I imagine.
Well, yes.
And how many are there in the book?
You know, I can't even tell you the exact number. People keep asking me that, and I'm like, why don't I know? But we can definitely say they're over 100. I think they're about 110. Some of the recipes are more kind of paragraph-style recipes that are at the end of the mushroom chapters versus a really formal recipe that are similar to the mushrooms or the recipes in the back.
In the second half of the book.
In the second half of the book. And the last chapter, I organized the recipes based on the season because that's when the mushrooms, are going to be appearing seasonally, as are a lot of the other regional ingredients that I really try to make an important part of the recipes. But the last chapter that I just call the larder are recipes that are going to help you preserve if you've gotten a large harvest of something. So there are different things that you can make.
Well, it's a wonderful book, and I'm hanging on to my copy. I want to thank you both very much, Michael and Lisa, for being with us today. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's our pleasure.
Yep.
Michael Carnes, a certified mycological identification expert, Lisa Golden Schroeder, a food journalist, and they have a wonderful book along with Dennis Becker. It's called Untamed Mushrooms from Field to Table from University of Minnesota Press. Great to have them with us. And thank you for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.